and welcome to Travel Fun. My name is Mary Beth Clementi, and I'm the host of this talk show on travel. And this week, I am taking you to the national parks, a good number of our country's national parks, and I am going to be chatting with James Kaiser. James is actually on the phone from Costa Rica, and he is the author of four guidebooks on four different national parks in the U.S., one on Acadia, one on Joshua Tree, another on the Grand Canyon, and the other on Yosemite. And I would like to welcome James Kaiser to Travel Fun. Hi, James.
Hey, how are you?
Good. It's good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
And you are an award-winning travel writer, photographer, and national parks expert. And your first book is called Acadia, The Complete Guide. And why don't you tell us right off how that came about?
Right. So, it is funny looking back now. You know, I've written these four guidebooks. I've won some awards. I've sold a lot of guides. And it's interesting how I stumbled into this because I never set out intending to be a travel guidebook author. I graduated from Dartmouth College in 1999. And when I graduated, I had no clue what I wanted to do with myself. The world was wide open, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know what kind of career I wanted. I was just sort of at a loss. And I did know that I wanted to go back to coastal Maine, where I was born and, you know, where I'd grown up, and spend, you know, sort of a final summer there, you know, with my friends before I went out and had to get a real job, you know, something in an office, something in front of a computer, you know, before I had to grow up and sort of, you know, accept my fate in a cubicle. So I went back to Maine, and, you know, while I was there, I went back to Acadia National Park, which, you know, I had spent my summers and college summers, working outside the park. And I just looked around at some of the guidebooks that were available to the park, and I didn't think that any of them really captured, the essence of the place. Like, none of them really put forth what was so incredible about Acadia National Park. And so I thought, you know, I've grown up here. I know the park like the back of my hand. I know locals. I know a lot about the place that a lot of people just visiting don't know. So I thought, you know, why don't I try to write my own guidebook? And it was one of these things that just sort of seemed like, you know, an interesting idea, something fun to do. And so I spent the whole summer, you know, researching and gathering information and taking photos. And at, you know, the end of that summer, I sat down, and that's when the hard work really began, and I actually had to put the thing together. And it sort of mushroomed into this project that was far bigger than I had ever imagined. But when the book came out, it was hugely popular. Stores carried it all over the island, and people loved it. And I did really well with it. You know, it was sort of a big hit. And I thought, well, you know, I really enjoyed doing that guidebook. I want to do another one. So I moved out west to do more guidebooks to other national parks. And I just kept going from there.
Sounds great. That's the way life goes, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's like I said, I had never intended, you know, to sort of set out and pursue a dream job. But it's sort of how it wound up happening. And I'm thrilled. I love it.
It's interesting because as we were talking earlier, we're comparing notes from one guidebook author to another. And I've also written four guidebooks, and I didn't expect either to be a guidebook author or a writer for that matter. And I got into it because I had a shopping service in Paris that had a lot of attention. So we never know what life has in store for us.
Exactly.
Now, have you always been passionate about nature and the national parks in particular?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly nature. You know, growing up in Maine, growing up in rural Maine, you can't help but, sort of have a love for nature. And, I mean, that's, you know, when your kid's running around, that's what you do. You go hiking, canoeing, You know, water skiing in the summer. I mean, you're just always outdoors. It's always there. There's no sort of concrete jungle to be found. So, yeah, you know, growing up, I just had this, you know, love of nature. I didn't really realize it as much at the time until I moved to a big city later on, you know, just how important all that was to me. But, yeah, always loved that. And, you know, I always grew up going to Acadia National Park, and I visited national parks with my family when I was, you know, younger. I remember going to Yellowstone, and, you know, those experiences are always sort of like, wow, you know, especially going out west. The landscapes are just so bold and dramatic out there that it really captured my attention. And I think that that was part of, you know, what I thought about when I decided, okay, after having done the guidebook to Acadia National Park, you know, I think I thought back to, you know, those spectacular places that I had been to, you know, as a kid, and thought, wow, you know, I want to check those places out. I want to learn more about those places and do, you know, guidebooks to those national parks.
Your books are rich with photography, with images of the parks. How did that come about? How did you get into photography?
You know, it's interesting. I actually came pretty late in life to photography. It actually wasn't until I started working on my first Acadia guidebook that I actually bought a camera and started seriously taking photos. Now, that said, I'd always been a kid that was really into art. You know, I loved drawing and painting, and so I had sort of a lot of experience with that. I'd taken a lot of classes. You know, I had a very good eye for art, and so I think the photography just came sort of naturally, you know, when I decided to pick up a camera. And I got a camera because I thought, you know, hey, if I'm going to do this guidebook, you know, to a national park, to a place with all this incredible, amazing scenery, it's got to have some photos. You know, you've got to be able to see what these places look like. And I thought for, you know, all the hiking trails, if you're planning a vacation and you say, okay, you know, we want to go on a hike, what hike do we want to go on? A photograph, I mean, it's true, a picture's worth a thousand words. And so if you can actually see what the hikes would look like, that'll help you immensely with your trip planning. And I feel that's true for everything in a travel guide. I mean, if you have pictures that can reveal what the places look like, that's invaluable as far as trip planning is concerned.
I agree. And you have a good selection of your images, of your photos, on your website blog, and that's jameskaiser.com. And most of them are also for sale. So that's nice. People should check that out, jameskaiser.com. Okay, so I'm going to ask you for the condensed version of your four books in a few minutes, or let's say 5 minutes or less for each one.
Okay.
Let's start out with your first one, Acadia, The Complete Guide. Why don't you give us the rundown on this park and some of the highlights?
Right. So Acadia National Park is located about two-thirds of the way up the coast of Maine. And it's basically, I mean, to help people visualize it, if you're familiar with Martha's Vineyard, you know, off the coast of Cape Cod in Massachusetts, it is pretty much exactly the same size, 108 square miles, as Martha's Vineyard. Now, the main difference is Mount Desert Island, which is located two-thirds up the way of the coast of Maine and where Acadia National Park is located, it's an island by about 50 feet at low tide. So there's actually a bridge that connects the island to the mainland. So you can drive right from the mainland onto the island. But it's this amazing island on the coast of Maine that, in addition to being quite large, has a mountain range running through the center of the island. So it actually, if you look at the mountains, and there's something like, you know, 17, 18, I forget the exact number of mountain peaks on the island, you know, these are really, really prominent mountains for the East Coast. I mean, if you think of the East Coast, most of it is pretty flat. And, I mean, most of the East Coast is pretty sandy from Florida, you know, up until New England. And then you start getting some craggy, rocky coasts. You really start getting a lot of that in Maine. And then you hit Mount Desert Island, which its highest mountain is Cadillac Mountain. It's about 1,500 feet high. It's actually the highest point on the eastern seaboard north of Rio de Janeiro.
1,500 feet high is the highest point on the eastern seaboard?
Yep.
Wow.
Now, you have mountains that are higher. I mean, clearly, like the White Mountains, Mount Catan,
right.
You know, there are many mountains inland that are much higher. But as far as a mountain that's right on the coast, it is the highest on the eastern seaboard.
Oh, that must be impressive.
It's amazing. And, you know, for centuries, you know, back when most people traveled, you know, the sea was the main artery of you know, commerce and transportation. This island was used as a navigational beacon because you could see it, you know, up to 60 miles out at sea. These days, you know, now that we have a national park that protects, you know, this mountain range and the land surrounding it, you have these fantastic hiking trails that go up pretty much all of the mountains. So you can hike up these mountains, and you've just got the most extraordinary coastal views. There's nothing else like it on the East Coast. I mean, you hike up these mountains, and if you're hiking around this time of year, they're just covered with wild blueberry bushes, and you look out over the ocean on a clear day. There are dozens of offshore islands. There are lighthouses. There are sailboats. I mean, it's just truly extraordinary. And if you like hiking and you like the ocean, there's no better place on the East Coast than Acadia National Park.
Okay, that sounds great. I have to admit, I haven't been there, but can't wait to go. All right, how about Joshua Tree? You've written Joshua Tree, The Complete Guide.
Mm-hmm. So Joshua Tree was actually the second guidebook that I wrote. And Joshua Tree is located in the desert in Southern California, and it's about 2 hours east of L.A. driving. And it's just north of Palm Springs. So that'll help people sort of visualize where it is. And the park is actually located on the border of the Mojave Desert and the Sonoran Desert, you know, which are two of the four major deserts that you're going to find in North America. And the whole reason the Joshua Tree was set aside, there was a lady named Minerva Hoyt who she loved going out to Joshua Tree because she loved the variety of desert plants out there. Because the park, what later became the park, lied on the boundary of these two deserts, it had plants and animals from both of these ecosystems. And you just had, you know, incredible, you know, desert vegetation, most prominently the Joshua Tree. And so you had this incredible desert flora and fauna, which is why the park was initially created. But today, Joshua Tree is actually much more famous because it is a rock climbing Mecca. You know, in the winter when people aren't climbing in the mountains in places like Yosemite, people go to Joshua Tree because it has thousands of climbs over these, there are these granite outcrops. It's sort of these crazy, it almost looks like something that Dr. Seuss or Salvador Dali would create, these crazy boulder piles throughout the desert, and there are terrific rock climbs up these boulder piles. And so now, you know, I don't know what the exact statistic is, but I would say probably 50% or more, you know, of the people that spend the night in the park are rock climbers. It's just a climbing mecca. You know, climbers from all over the world go to visit there. And it's just, you know, you've got incredible scenery. You've got incredible outdoor adventure with the rock climbing and just a beautiful and very unusual, you know, landscape in America.
And what would the weather be like in the dead of summer and also the dead of winter?
In the dead of summer, it'll be very hot. Joshua Tree is not a park that you're going to want to spend a whole lot of time outdoors in the dead of summer. Now, the temperature is absolutely divine at night. You know, it's sort of perfect for camping. But as soon as the sun comes up, it starts baking. In the winter, it definitely gets chilly, especially in the higher elevations of the park. I mean, it can snow in Joshua Tree, but it's, you know, obviously a lot less cold than you're going to find in, you know, some of the mountain national parks. And so even though it might get a little chilly, you know, you can still rock climb there and be active during the day. The best times to visit are really sort of, you know, the late fall and the early spring. You know, there's about a two-month window where it's just divine. And especially in the spring, you get these wildflower blooms, you know, where the desert is just covered with sort of this technicolor explosion of wildflowers. And, you know, that's one more reason to visit the park and what makes the park special.
Okay. I am visiting with James Kaiser, author of four travel books on four different national parks. And his website is jameskaiser.com, and Kaiser is K-A-I-S-E-R. And I will definitely be putting this interview up as a podcast on my website blog, and that's bonjourcolorado.com. We're going to take a short break and be right back to talk about the Grand Canyon, Yosemite, and more. Be right back. Hello, and welcome back to Travel Fun. I am visiting with James Kaiser, travel writer, photographer, and national parks expert. And so far we've talked about Acadia, Joshua Tree, and now James, the granddaddy of them all. In a few minutes, certainly less than five, what do you have to say about the Grand Canyon?
Right. Well, God, 5 minutes. How do you include everything that the Grand Canyon has to offer in 5 minutes? But I'll definitely give it a try here. So the Grand Canyon, I mean, it's world famous. You know, it's this incredible. I think it's probably the greatest natural feature in North America. I mean, you can see it from space. It's just staggering. Now, the thing about Grand Canyon is, a lot of people that come to Grand Canyon, and this is actually what happened to me when I was in college. You know, I was driving out to California one summer, and, you know, I thought, okay, I'm going to go visit the Grand Canyon, see it for the first time. And, you know, I pulled up, I went to the rim, I looked out, it's breathtaking, it's gorgeous, and, you know, you just almost can't believe what you're looking at. And, you know, after, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you sort of think, well, this is extraordinary, you know. But what is there to do in the Grand Canyon? You know, I mean, what is there other than just this spectacular view? And it's not to downplay that view at all, but, you know, it's sort of a bit overwhelming when you get there. And so for me, you know, when I set out to write my Grand Canyon guide, you know, I set out to show people that, you know, the Grand Canyon is so much more than just a pretty view. There is hiking. I mean, Grand Canyon has these hikes that start at the rim, they go in the Colorado River. You know, as you're hiking down, you're hiking through, you know, nearly 2 billion years of geological history arranged chronologically for your viewing pleasure. So if you like geology, to be able to walk through these rock layers that were once, you know, ancient deserts and shallow tropical seas, and, you know, to go down through history like that is just a completely unique experience. And, I mean, where else can you start a hike at the top, finish at the bottom? You know, it's sort of a mountain in reverse style of hiking is what they call it. So if you like hiking and you like geology, I mean, it's one of the most extraordinary places that you could hike, you know, anywhere in the world. On top of that, I mean, I personally consider the greatest outdoor adventure in North America to be a whitewater rafting trip through the Grand Canyon. You know, the Grand Canyon, the Colorado River is sort of the Nile of America. You know, it's this grand desert river that we have flowing through the Southwest. And, you know, right now there are dams that, you know, sort of plug up a lot of the Colorado River. Grand Canyon is a 277-mile stretch of the Colorado River that flows free. And so when you're going through the Grand Canyon, you know, you're experiencing this gorgeous river that's flowing through, you know, some of the most spectacular scenery you've ever seen. I mean, if you think the view from the rim of Grand Canyon is good, you got to see it from the bottom, from the Colorado River, because looking up when you're a mile deep in the earth is just spectacular. There are these side canyons that you can hike to, where you hike to waterfalls, you can hike to Anasazi ruins. It's just absolutely phenomenal. So, you know, what I set out to accomplish with the Grand Canyon book, in addition to, you know, sort of providing the background history, the nature, the geology, all of this, is to show people that, hey, here's this park that most people completely miss. You know, they go and they look over the edge and they see it, and, you know, and that's an extraordinary thing. I'm not downplaying it at all, but there's so much more to the Grand Canyon. And if you like outdoor adventure, you know, it's an extraordinary place.
And I have to add a little bit here because the Grand Canyon, out of the four parks that you've covered in your guidebooks, the Grand Canyon is the only one that I've been to. And I've been there twice, and recently last fall with my parents. So I saw it from a little bit different perspective, less adventuresome because my parents are older. Mm-hmm. And it's just incredible, all of the international tourists that you see there. And I think there are so many Americans that are missing out on what's in their own backyard.
Oh, and absolutely. And, you know, this is true of most of the national parks that I go to, where, you know, maybe 50% of the visitors are foreign. And, you know, these are people who they flew halfway around the world to see, you know, these incredible sites that we have here in the U.S. And I think that, yeah, I think there is a tendency to sort of ignore what's in your backyard. And, you know, when people think about, oh, I want to go on a vacation, you know, so often people want to go to, you know, they want to go to Thailand, they want to go to Tibet, they want to go to Costa Rica, or they, you know, all these different places because it's exotic. You know, you come back, you tell your friends, you know, your friends are very impressed, you know, they get a little jealous, you know, you've had this incredible experience. But I got to say, having traveled all around the world, you know, I still come back to the U.S. national parks and I think, man, these are some of the most incredible places on the planet. And, you know, it is a shame that more people don't, you know, view them the way that a lot of foreigners view them, which are just world-class destinations. So that's another thing I hope, you know, I hope with my guidebooks I can, you know, sort of show more Americans that, hey, look, we have these incredible places in our country. You know, you need to go out and take advantage of it.
Right. Well, you and I are doing our part about spreading the word. And I just want to add briefly, there's so much to do in the Grand Canyon aside from adventure travel type things. And my mom and I, for example, loved the shopping.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I wanted to add that. Okay, so chat a little bit about Yosemite.
Okay, so Yosemite, it's located sort of in the heart of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. So the Sierra Nevada Mountains, you know, they run up sort of the spine of California, and they're a gorgeous mountain range. You know, they're the youngest mountain range in the U.S., and they have this sort of like rugged, you know, beautiful granite profiles. And Yosemite is, you know, I think considered by most people to be the most spectacular part of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Now, the whole national park, you know, is huge, but it's famous for just this one little section, Yosemite Valley, which is about a mile wide by about 7 miles long. And it is one of the most spectacular mountain valleys you'll ever set eyes on. You know, it's got these 3,000-foot high cliffs. It's got these enormous waterfalls. You know, some of the highest waterfalls in North America and some of the highest waterfalls in the world are located in Yosemite Valley. You know, it's home to sort of the birthplace of big wall rock climbing. So people that, you know, are rock climbers, I mean, Yosemite is a mecca. I mean, it is El Capitan, which is, you know, this giant granite cliff, you know, that really defines one section of Yosemite Valley. It's like Mount Everest to rock climbers. I mean, it is world famous, and that's where some of the most legendary climbers have learned how to rock climb, where, you know, some of today's top climbers practice and train. So it's this, in addition to being this beautiful valley, it also has this incredible history of rock climbing. Now, that is the most famous part of Yosemite National Park, Yosemite Valley. But outside of the valley, you also have this whole other park, you know, that's just an alpine wonderland. So if you go out of Yosemite Valley, you know, you're going to go up into what they call the High Sierra, which is the Sierra Nevada Mountains above 8,000 feet. And you're going to, you know, find more great rock climbing. You're going to find unbelievable backpacking. I mean, you're sort of, once you get above treeline, you're just hiking and backpacking in this sort of ocean of granite. And it's just breathtaking, and the weather is divine. I mean, California has this incredible Mediterranean climate, and Yosemite during the summer is just filled with, you know, like beautiful blue sky days. You know, the occasional rainstorm comes through, but for the most part, I mean, you've just got the most consistently incredible weather. Perfect for hiking, perfect for rock climbing. It's just an extraordinary place.
All right, and that's Yosemite. You've done a super job, James, giving the condensed version of all four of the parks that you've written about. Out of these four national parks, is there anything, person, place, thing, experience, that just grabbed you the most that you'd like to share?
Oh, that's a really tough question. You know, I'd have to say if I had to pick one thing, it would be the first whitewater rafting trip that I did through Grand Canyon. You know, I look back on that trip and I think, you know, that's probably one of the top three trips I've ever taken anywhere in the world. You know, just it opened my eyes, you know, not only to Grand Canyon, but sort of to the fact that there are these places in the United States that are so overwhelmingly incredible, that can be completely overlooked. And, you know, I think that sort of, you know, trained me a bit to sort of look at things with a fresh set of eyes and realize that, you know, sometimes the most beautiful things are the things that are, you know, all around you, but that you're just not paying attention to.
And how many days were you on the rafting trip in the Grand Canyon? Because I know there are several different options you can take.
Yeah, definitely. That was, at that point, I think it was a 19-day trip, which I don't actually think they allow trips that long anymore. They've sort of readjusted. They've had to readjust the permit system for going through Grand Canyon because they actually limit the number of river runners every year. And that you know, helps prevent overcrowding. You know, it helps, you know, protect the ecosystem. I think now the longest trip you might be able to do is like 15 days, but it's on the order of 2 weeks. So that was also something that was really special. I'm really glad I got to squeeze in 19 days, you know, in the Grand Canyon. Just, you know, by the time I climbed out, I was, you know, a caveman, you know,
right.
Big beard and, you know, totally sunburned and probably not smelling too good, but I was feeling like a million bucks.
Without email and cell phone and TV and
totally disconnected. I remember actually getting into my rental car at the end of that trip and, you know, it was wonderful being disconnected and unplugged, and you sort of, you know, your mind sort of settles into, you know, this peaceful mode. But, you know, I got to say, listening to the radio, listening to music after 19 days, it was the greatest, you know, music I'd ever listened to.
Nice. Okay, so here's something else that obviously must have really impressed you a lot, because you have a separate website blog that you've created for that. And that's YosemiteFirefall.com.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Okay, so that would be a terrific runner-up to, you know, something incredible that I've seen in the national park that's just taken my breath away. The Firefall, well, there were two firefalls. The historic firefall, which a lot of people are familiar with, was a ceremony that went on for about 100 years in Yosemite National Park, where on top of Glacier Point, which is this, you know, giant cliff that rises, this, you know, giant vertical wall that rises above Yosemite Valley, every night they build a bonfire, and at sunset they would push the embers, the sort of glowing hot red embers, over the side of the cliff, and it would sort of be this glittering waterfall of fire tumbling down to the valley, and, you know, everyone would gather around, they'd look up at it, and they were oohing and aahing. But obviously, it's kind of a spectacle, you know, and, you know, as attitudes about the national parks sort of starting to change, you know, about 50 years ago, people realized that this was sort of an unnatural thing, wasn't really what the national parks were about, and so ultimately it was discontinued it was either 1968 or 1969. Now, the amazing thing is, a lot of people were very sad to see it go. They loved the firefall. They thought it was wonderful. But a few years after they discontinued this man-made artificial firefall, a photographer named Galen Roll took a photograph of what is now called the natural firefall in Yosemite Valley. And the natural firefall is a waterfall that tumbles off the eastern side of El Capitan. And for about 2 weeks in mid to late February, the setting sun hits this waterfall at the perfect angle that it perfectly illuminates the waterfall right at sunset. And so right at sunset, this waterfall glows sort of brilliant orange and red, and it's just perfectly illuminated. And it is, I've seen it two or three times. It is one of the most incredible natural phenomena I've ever seen. And it's incredible to think that this was something that was really only discovered a couple decades ago. And it's in this valley that's already home to all these amazing sites. I mean, it's not like Yosemite Valley needed anything more to be incredible, but now we know it has this natural waterfall. And this thing's getting bigger and bigger every year. I mean, I was there this past year, you know, doing a live blog every day. You know, I tried to photograph the firefall because it depends on weather conditions. If it's rainy or if it's snowy, you know, you're not going to get the shot. You're not going to be able to see it. But there were people, you know, I would guess thousands of people. And I talked to people that had flown all the way from Japan, all the way from Europe, just to get a chance to photograph this thing. So it gets bigger and bigger every year, and more people find out about it. And, you know, it's this terrific, terrific thing. I think, you know, if you like waterfalls, if you like national parks, you're looking for something to do in mid-February, you know, the firefall should be at the top of your list.
Okay, James, unfortunately, we're out of time.
Okay.
I do want to say that there's a link to the Yosemite Firefall on your website, blog, and some great photos, as well as all kinds of other information about your work. And that's jameskaiser.com. And once again, I am going to be posting this interview as a podcast at bonjourcolorado.com. James, it's been a pleasure. Continued success with all. And thanks for being a guest on Travel Fun.
Thank you so much. I loved it. It was absolutely wonderful talking to you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.